little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob. In this episode of Thinking Clearly, we will explore vulnerabilities in our U.S. democratic system, the current level of confidence in our democracy, the process of deliberative polling, how institutionalizing deliberative political processes can lead to deliberative democracy and reduce polarization, as well as a variety of other topics.
And building on his educational foundation with a bachelor's degree from Yale College, with a double major in political science and philosophy, our guest, James Fishkin, continued his studies, earning a PhD in political science at Yale, and later a PhD in philosophy from the University of Cambridge. And his academic career path took him from professorships at Yale to the University of Texas to his current position as professor of communication and professor of political science at Stanford University, where he also serves as a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies and as the director of the Stanford Deliberative Democracy Lab. Jim Fishkin is especially known for his work in researching and developing, through extensive field testing, the process of deliberative polling and clarifying its relationship to deliberative democracy, which is a form of democracy in which deliberation is central to decision-making. And he's written a number of books exploring political theory, justice, political opinion, and democracy. But his most recent book, Can Deliberation Cure the Ills of Democracy?, provides the focus for our discussion on this episode. Jim Fishkin, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. Thanks for coming. Let's just jump right into it. Intuitively, the convergence of philosophy and political science would seem to guide one's interest in exploring the relationship of deliberation and democracy. But I'm wondering, were there other catalysts along the way that led to your work focusing on how deliberative processes might be able to cure the ills of democracy?
Well, I started focusing on the limitations of public opinion as reported in standard public opinion surveys. And I realized that they offered a rather poor approximation to anything that really deserved to be called the will of the people. And the problem that as I saw it, and as I continue to think about it, is that democracy has to make a connection to the will of the people. A connection between what the considered judgments of the people are and what's actually done. But there's several impediments to that. First of all, most people, as social science, going back to the late Anthony Downs in the 1950s showed, is that most people are, quote, rationally ignorant, unquote. That is, most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about the complexities of politics or public policy. Why should they? They've got only one voice in millions, and they've got other things to do. They've got jobs, families, whatever it is where they can make an immediate difference. Would that it were otherwise. We'd like informed and engaged citizens to be part of our democracy. But a lot of people opt out, and when they're polled, they give just surface impressions of sound bites and headlines, or perhaps they answer questions without having any opinion at all, as in the famous Public Affairs Act of 1975, which people offered answers to, but it didn't exist. There was no Public Affairs Act of 1975. Then 20 years later, the Washington Post celebrated the non-existent anniversary of the non-existent Public Affairs Act of 1975, asking what people thought about its repeal. Half the sample were told that the Republicans wanted to repeal it and half that the Democrats wanted to repeal it. And based on that, they got quite different answers. But you can't repeal something that doesn't exist. So in addition to those people who are only vaguely attentive, there are other true believers who pay a lot of attention, but they are not representative of the rest of the public. And as social media has developed, people are increasingly in their filter bubbles or their enclaves, where they may only be aware of their side of the argument and not the other side of the argument. So I also became increasingly interested in the question, what would they think if they actually seriously engaged with the other side? And I soon discovered that that's not just exposing them to information, because that will likely produce a backlash or a hostile or defensive reaction. But the question that I wanted to ask is if you can engage them in civil discussion over enough time that they actually begin to listen to each other, what would happen? And the results have been quite startling. And that has led to this design that I have for what I call deliberative polling, and for our efforts to actually scale that design beyond stratified random samples to even the broader public. But it has very great benefits. So that's a relatively long answer to your question.
That's a great answer because it gives us an overview. How many years have you been actually working on this?
I proposed it in a short article in the Atlantic Monthly in August 1988. Yeah. And it took a while to get it started. And we now have about 160 cases around the world.
That's a good overview. Where I'd like to start is with your working definitions. Let's take your book title apart a little bit here. When I read titles, I like to pick out what the key terms are. And the key terms in your book's title are deliberation and democracy. So those are two of the key terms. Give us your working definition for those, and then give us kind of a big picture summary of the connection between those terms and the other key terms, which are cure and ills.
I take the term cure from some phraseology of James Madison, who talked about curing the mischiefs of faction. And by faction, he meant groups that were motivated by passions or interests adverse to the rights of others or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. And controlling faction, basically controlling tyranny of the majority, was the big problem facing democracies. Indeed, why the American founders didn't even want to use the term democracy, because the mob had killed Socrates and there had been Shay's rebellion. So they were afraid of the mob. Now, deliberation is, in my view, the root of the term deliberation is weighing the competing considerations. And we want citizens to weigh the arguments, the reasons for and against particular policies, and come to an informed conclusion about how they would manage those trade-offs. Now, democracy has to make some connection to the public will, but that means you need to think about what the public will is. And if it's got to be more than just an impression of sound bites and headlines, which often can be manipulated or influenced by distraction, misinformation, disinformation. And so people need a good evidence-based basis for considering. And instrumental to that is discussion. It turns out that mere exposure doesn't change opinion, but if you have a chance to really discuss with other people, very often magical things happen. So we have found that moderated discussion with diverse others produces some real movement of opinion. We're not necessarily trying to move opinion. We're trying to facilitate people coming to their own considered judgments about what needs to be done. And imagine if we had a society where people, by and large, did that, I think we would have a different kind of democracy.
Very good. We could insert that into John Lennon's song, Imagine, you know. But we are not a political show here. So listeners might be wondering why we're talking about political science and governing and all of that kind of thing. And you made it clear as to why we're doing that, because you used words like weighing the reasons, evidence-based, and that's all we're about here on Thinking Clearly. So that's what caught my attention when I saw your book and saw your work.
Speaking of your book, As you quote in your book, Benjamin Franklin, when asked, what form of government will it be, a monarchy or a republic? And famously replied, a republic if you can keep it. In your opinion, what are the most serious vulnerabilities in our system of democracy, those that could become existential threats and possibly even lead to democratic collapse?
I think that we need to pay some attention to the norms that protect democracy, the norms about following the law, the norms about the guardrails of how people need to behave to respect the law and to respect our election processes, and the more general civil norms about mutual respect rather than always castigating the other side. There's a lot of law breaking going on, and the courts are getting overwhelmed with trying to enforce that. I don't want to get into a whole discussion of the current administration, but I think that there's a deeper problem that has been brewing for a long time about the guardrails of democracy. Even said simple things as counting the votes without partisan interference, doing something about gerrymandering. Eventually, we have to get to doing something about campaign finance. When countries move towards what's called competitive authoritarianism, when they continue to retain the apparatus of elections, but they become more authoritarian, there's a lot of aspects to that involving the media, the civil society, the universities, even the quest for a factual basis for making decisions, the legitimacy of science. All of these things are aspects to what seems to be under threat right now. These are great challenges because they cover the whole gamut of having a shared public sphere where people can get information, discuss issues with others, and come to informed conclusions. And if you can't have that, you don't have the public opinion that is essential for the democratic process to work.
Can you get into just a little bit more about those guardrails? Because we hear that all the time. You mentioned a couple of them, but are they things that are actually codified or somehow in law, in the Constitution?
Some of them are just norms. Some of them are just norms. They're just things that are not done, but, you know, where sometimes the legal system and the legislative process hasn't even bothered to codify them. But nevertheless, I think the problems are all fueled by extreme partisan polarization, which infect both of the major parties to a considerable degree, where the perception that if the other side wins, the world will end or may end. Now, I happen to think that the violations of the guardrails are more on one side than the other, but nevertheless, it's the extreme partisan polarization is they're mirror images of each other. As an unintended consequence of well-meaning reforms combined with a change in our system of political communication, and by that I really mean social media, the rise of cable news, earlier it was the rise of talk radio, targeted communication to specific groups. And then the vulnerability even for disinformation, for robot armies of bots who may spread complete fabrications. The breakdown of what John Stuart Mill in On Liberty thought that error would be self-correcting because people would eventually hear the corrections. But if they never hear the corrections, it can't be self-correcting. And people just live with the errors, having no idea what people on the other side would think. Deliberative democracy within a microcosm can correct for that. And if it were spread more broadly, it could correct for that with the broader population. But in the way we currently operate, with most people not spending a lot of time paying a lot of attention to political matters because of rational ignorance, you have a vast swath of the public that's just going to have only the vaguest impressions of what's going on.
When you mentioned the norms aspect, things that we sort of took for granted, the behaviors and conduct of politicians and policies. There's no doubt that those are being severely challenged. And I don't mind saying during the first Trump administration and the last 100-plus days, we've seen a lot of things that we just took for granted that wouldn't happen. So that leads to talking about what people's opinions, overall opinions, the public opinion of the performance of U.S. democracy. And I was looking at a public poll showing that it was declining. It was the Brightline Watch poll, which is conducted by several college and university professors from multiple campuses. And that poll indicates that on a rating scale of 0 to 100, surveying people's overall opinion of overall performance of U.S. democracy. And it was about 58 on a scale of 0 to 100, 58 back last year, at the end of last year, December 2024. And it was 58. And then in the start of the first year, in February, it fell to 53. And then the last one I saw, it was 49 in April of 2025. And according to them, that's the first time it's fallen below 50 since they began collecting public data in 2018. So what do you think are the major factors driving this lack of confidence?
Well, same results you'd get from if you looked at the Freedom House polls, if you looked at the Economist ratings about democracy. We seem to be on the road to a breakdown in the norms and the guardrails of democracy, respect for elections, the interference with elections, confidence in the election process, all the same things we've been talking about. We seem to be moving towards a system that may become a competitive authoritarian system where we still have elections, but the danger is that they could become rigged or lopsided so that it's very hard to dislodge an oligarchy in power. It's the fear of that that I think is motivating the decline in the ratings. So the countries that are at the top of these evaluations, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, Norway, of course, they're small, and they have been dealing with populist movements as well, but they have a firmer grip on the maintaining the sanctity of their elections and the competitiveness of the elections. So hopefully we can right the ship in a bit. The one thing that really does capture the public, whether they're paying a lot of attention or not, is what political scientists call retrospective voting. If the economy in particular is going bad, retrospective voting says they vote the bums out. There are aspects to the policymaking of the current administration, the tariffs, the mass deportations that will have effects on the economy. And people may not need their social media to tell them if the prices are going up for the cost of living of essentials, or if they have problems at getting their health care because Medicaid has been cut, or whatever the economic consequences are. So retrospective voting gets the attention of the inattentive and may have a big effect. So if you ask me about what I think is likely to happen, that's a challenge for the current administration. The same retrospective voting that put them into power may have an effect later. But of course, we don't know. The tariffs change from day to day, but there are some predictable effects. All of this is sort of second best in my view. We really need a democracy in which citizens are paying more attention and are more engaged with the issues than just voting by the rearview mirror of some basic aspects of life.
As we know, we're well over 100 days into Trump's presidency. Considering actions from his administration, which, if any, of those do you see as serious threats to our democratic institutions? And what are your predictions for likely scenarios leading up to the midterm elections?
Well, my predictions have to do with the one big monster that often determines elections, as I said, is retrospective voting. And so, therefore, the economic policies that may lead the cost of living to go up, inflation to go up, unemployment to go up, or the access to the healthcare system to be more limited, these things will have an effect on voters across the board. And red states, blue states, if Medicaid is cut, rural hospitals will close. There's all kinds of things, effects like that, that are likely to have an effect in the midterms and in the later years of this administration. That's about the best I can do in terms of predictions, because nobody knows how these economic decisions will come out, but an awful lot of economists think that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, we certainly don't expect you to have a crystal ball about the midterm elections. It seems like everyone does these days. I think the other part of the question was, now that we're well over 100 days into Trump's second presidency, which, if any, of the administration's actions do you see as serious threats to our democratic institutions?
Firing of federal employees, the attack on science, the attack on independent media like PBS and NPR, the attempt to intimidate universities. These are major challenges, and they fit the pattern of competitive authoritarianism in other countries, the experience in Hungary, for example. These are big challenges.
You've mentioned competitive authoritarianism a couple times. Could you help me understand what that may or does look like in our country right now in this time and place?
Well, attacking the credibility of elections is part of it. Attacking those who would speak truth to power in whatever context. Attacking all independent sources of influence, law firms, universities, civil society. That's part of the competitive authoritarian playbook.
Yeah, and it seems like in the current administration, there's a, I would just sum it up or generalize it as a looking for vulnerabilities that exist against the accumulation of power in the executive branch. It seems like a lot of what's been done is testing, well, if I do this, am I going to be countered by the judicial or the Congress and that kind of thing. So it seems to me that, at least in my mind, that I can kind of sum up things that way. It's a test of the norms, as you word you used, that we're used to in terms of the distribution of power between the three branches of government. I don't know. I think in terms of not only how things will play out, it's what kinds of challenges are going to be made to that. Are people going to get out in the streets enough and demonstrate? Are there going to be enough civil suits? Is the judicial branch going to step up? There's a lot of things in play there. That's why it's very difficult to
Right.
tell.
But my book is about longer term issues. It wasn't written about the current administration.
Yes, and we're going to get into that. And I love the way your book is organized because in the earlier chapters, it lays kind of the theoretical, historical foundations of what you're talking about in the book. And then it's followed by the experimental evidence and field testing of deliberative models. And then the last chapter wraps things up and sort of gives some ideas of integrating that deliberative process into our political system. So let's go with your intuitions now and take some time to dig into this process of deliberation. You described it generally, but let's dig into some of the details of that because you did use terms in the last chapter about the deliberative process using language where a format is to encourage civil evidence-based discussion, mutual respect. And that sounds like a lot of things that Julie and I have talked about, interviewed people talking about, and actually demonstrated here on Thinking Clearly with the added idea of throwing in critical thinking. You've already mentioned it, evidence-based reasoning using logic. Why don't you detail that deliberative process? How do you envision participants' communication by using that process, nudge towards civil evidence-based discussion and mutual respect.
One additional aspect I want to add into the mix is that we do this with representative samples of the public, stratified random samples. And so the American One Room series was 500 or more, up to 1,000 people who deliberated, as well as separate control groups who didn't deliberate, so we could see the effects of the deliberative process. And the reason that we have representative samples where we measure the opinions at the start and can compare them to the control group who are just answering a survey, they don't have to do anything else, so you don't have to worry about whether the people are different because they had to agree to come and spend a whole weekend. So our samples are representative of the public in their attitudes and demographics, and then they often change their opinions, and we try to figure out why they change their opinions. But the idea is that they should be representative of what the public would think if somehow everybody could undergo a similar process of thinking about the issues, weighing the trade-offs, and deciding what should be done. Another thing is that we collect the opinions in confidential questionnaires, in a way sort of like secret ballots, except we can, for research purposes, link the identities of the people at the end with the questions that they answered at the beginning or on first recruitment, so we can study the opinion changes. And that's very important because in some other processes, there's a lot of social pressure, like a jury trying to reach a verdict. So we want to know what the people think without the social pressure. The philosopher Habermas called the unforced force of the better argument. We want to know what they really would think if they considered the issues. So with that said, we divide the people randomly into small groups with trained moderators. Although I should also mention that we now have a technology, the Stanford Online Deliberation Platform that we developed with computer scientists here, that uses a bit of AI and allows the people to moderate themselves in small groups of 10. And it works extremely well. And that lowers the cost of deliberation. It's designed that so that we could spread it to millions if we could get them to participate in the platform. But let's go back to deliberative polling rather than deliberative scaling. Deliberative polling, we have a representative sample, we have background briefing materials on the issues that are on the agenda. And we have an independent advisory committee that advises on the issues and the balance of the materials. And the materials are about proposals and pros and cons, the strongest arguments that diverse groups of experts can identify for a proposal and against a proposal. And that provides the substance of the trade-offs that people can consider. Of course, they can bring their own ideas about other trade-offs, but this gets the discussion going. So what people do is with the moderator, with moderated discussion, either with the online platform or with human moderators, they work through the issues and the pros and cons of each proposal. Let's say there's an hour and a half small groups, an hour and a half plenary sessions. The plenary sessions are sessions with competing experts from different points of view who answer questions from the small groups. They don't give speeches. The people identify in the small groups the most important questions that they would like to get answered before they can come to their own informed judgments. And this process of alternating small groups and plenary sessions continues throughout a weekend. Then at the end, people never have to say how they come out on the issues, but they fill out a confidential questionnaire, and we can compare that to the one they filled out when they were first contacted, before they got the briefing document, before they started thinking about the issues, and we see the changes of opinion. And sometimes these changes are very large. That's why they were featured in the New York Times when we did America in One Room in 2019, and New York Times put all the pictures of the 500 and some participants in the newspaper, but they also featured the very dramatic changes of opinion and how the two parties changed. And both parties changed dramatically. Particularly notable, I think, was the Republicans changing on immigration. For example, about 80% of the Republicans initially wanted to send undocumented immigrants back to their quote-unquote home countries. And after deliberation, only 40% did. That's a drop of 40 percentage points. That's a humongous change. The Democrats changed up to 40 points on some of their proposals, too. So both sides changed on different issues. And I think the reason is they had never actually engaged with people who put a human face on the other side and a human voice. If you just expose them to information, they could dismiss it. But if you engage them with real human beings in that discussion, you can get those changes. And if you have a representative sample that represents the whole country, and we had our samples there were recruited by NORC from the University of Chicago, which is probably the best or one of the two best academic survey outfits in the country. And they got a really good sample, representative in virtually every way, and a control group that actually got the election just about perfect. But the treatment group, the people who deliberated, were equally representative, but changed their views through deliberation. That's the basic process.
So you're controlling the environment. It makes me think back to some of our hopes and dreams about what the internet would do. It can bring people together. But as it turns out, the internet now has influencers who make money by triggering people emotionally about issues and then feeding them bad information, distorted misinformation. And what you're doing is you're creating the sort of best opportunity for people to bring out their better angel, to bring out their search for understanding the other person and finding some common ground and maybe even modifying their own opinion. So, yeah, I think that's important. It's a critical aspect of what you're doing there and the personal contact. Maybe we can get into that a little bit later versus doing this online, because you're going to have to create a change somewhere. It's got to either influence our representatives in their legislation and how they approach it, or it's got to be spread enough so that the general public is becoming much more rational and critically thinking. I use that term in terms of their approach to their voting behavior and their belief.
Yeah. Can I tell you about voting behavior? Because it was very, very unusual.
Sure.
So we went back to those people in the 2019 American One Room, a year later in the election. And we got very dramatic results in terms of the people who deliberated compared to the control group. NORC's control group got the election almost exactly right. But the treatment group, the people who deliberated a year later, voted dramatically for Biden over Trump. And how did that happen? Because it was a year later. Most political scientists will tell you that if you want to intervene in an election, we weren't intending to intervene in an election. We were not trying to persuade people to do anything, just to think about the issues. They will say, intervene right before the election, otherwise people will forget. It has to be right before. This was a year before. So what happened? We have an article in the American Political Science Review called "Can Deliberation Have Lasting Effects?" And what we showed is that the people who deliberated became more civically engaged. And those people who became more civically engaged had a greater sense of political efficacy. They thought they had opinions worth listening to after deliberation as opposed to before. They kept learning more about the campaign. They kept becoming more knowledgeable because we had knowledge questions. And those are the people who changed their views, who differed considerably from the control group in how they voted. And we showed that their views at the time that they voted were directly connected to how they voted, and also their likelihood to vote more. So then we did a second one like that, American One Room on climate and energy policy, And we had 1,000 deliberators that NORC identified and a control group. And we did it with our online platform, which actually moderates the discussions without a human moderator. You see each other in groups of 10, sort of like a Zoom, but it manages the queue for talking, and nobody can talk for more than 45 seconds at a time. Then it goes to the next person. It continually asks the small group if they've discussed that proposal enough, can they move to the next one? It manages the time for the whole process, and it organizes the process by which people suggest questions that they think are the most important questions, and they vote, they edit the questions together, and then they vote on which are the most important questions, and those go to the plenary session. So it does everything our human moderators do. And so in that process, we went back to them a year later and saw how they voted in the midterm elections. And those people who deliberated voted to a significant extent in terms of their interest in the climate issue, while the control group voted on crime and immigration and all the things that you'd expect them to vote on in the midterm elections. So the online platform, which cuts the cost of doing these deliberative processes considerably, and with good samples, can have the same effects. And we've even tested that in an experiment in Finland, where for the parliament there, where 1/3 of a national sample was face-to-face, brought from around the country to Helsinki, where I was observing it. 1/3 was in on a Zoom with human moderators, and 1/3 was on the platform. And we got essentially the same results in all three cases. So in other words, we know the platform works. So my vision is that platform could spread it to millions of people for the right occasion to deliberate. And it turns out that there are increases in mutual respect, decreases in polarization that come with deliberating together, whether it's on the platform or face-to-face. And these are good benefits that could be spread to the whole society if there were enough opportunities to deliberate on this model.
On Thinking Clearly, we've talked a lot about extreme political polarization. And as mentioned in your book, your research indicates that deliberative process can reduce polarization. What are the ill effects of extreme polarization? How does it relate to the party system? And what is the evidence that deliberation can reduce polarization, some of which we were just talking about? And how do you think deliberation actually functions in reducing that polarization?
The problem with extreme partisan polarization is that it produces deadlock. And that feeds the perception that democracies can't get anything done. And that feeds the desirability in some people's eyes to have a strong man, or to have a system where you don't have all this business about separation of powers and various legal roadblocks. You have somebody who can get things done, because democracies can't get anything done because they just produce deadlock. Democracies need to get things done. And if the partisan polarization, at the level of political elites in a competitive democratic system is fueled by the polarization at the base for each party and in the public. And so we have a system, the primary system, which was launched partly in California and partly in the other West Coast states in around 1911, primaries, referendums, and recalls were supposed to bring power to the people. But the problem is which people actually turn out. And for primaries, the people who feel most strongly are the ones who turn out. And in this age of polarized media, they are the most polarized. And so the representatives, instead of trying to satisfy the median voter, they're trying to satisfy the people who turn out in the primaries. And if they're not careful, they will be primaried. Primaried has become a verb with a direct object, and the direct object is the person who steps out of line in the view of the more extreme people. That's what happened to Eric Cantor, who was second in line on the Republican side until he started saying a few notable things about how DACA, how the immigration issues might be dealt with and solved. And in a low turnout primary, he was eliminated. And then he had, because Virginia has a sore loser law, so that if you lose the primary, you can't run again as an independent or anything, he became a lobbyist. And that's the fate that hangs over many Democrats and Republicans if they enrage the people who feel most strongly. So, ironically, a well-meaning Democratic reform has become an agent of discipline for keeping the parties polarized. So we found that the people who deliberated, particularly the people who took the most extreme positions, moved closer together. The means of those positions moved considerably closer together as they begin to consider voices and concerns of people who were on the other side, which they normally would never encounter. They would never encounter in their social media feeds. They would never encounter in their choices of who to talk to, because people, when they talk politics or policy, if they do, tend to talk to people in similar social locations. And so the people who were most extreme moved. And we also found that the affective polarization is lessened. That is, the sense in which they disliked each other was lessened, because the process stimulates what's called the contact hypothesis, which was developed by Gordon Allport, a Harvard psychologist, many years ago, in a book called Prejudice, where he discovered that when people who differ greatly work together on a common project under conditions of equality, they tend to lessen their negative affect towards each other. They like each other much more. That comes as a byproduct of working together. And our people in the small groups work together on identifying the key questions that they want to ask, even if they disagree about what kinds of answers they expect. And so we find that we stimulate the contact hypothesis, and we open people up to thinking about the other side. So we decrease the polarization. And to the extent that we can do that, we could cure some of the ills of democracy. We could cure what Madison called the mischiefs of faction, the groups who have passions and interests, who we could cool those passions and get people to think about the issues and have better policymaking.
Well, I think you've made the case very well that deliberative processes inserted into our political activity and system at various places are going to take us to a better place and have the potential for doing that. In a way, it kind of insulates us or makes less prominent those kinds of negative voices that take us to the dark places that we hear on the internet and conspiracy theories and pushing our button, emotional button. So I think you've made that case well. I encourage listeners to, if you want to hear a lot more details about your field testing and things, to get your book, Can Deliberation Cure the Ills of Democracy? But let's move now. Where are we really going to try to insert these deliberative processes, make them what you call deliberative institutions, nudging us toward a more flourishing deliberative democracy. Now, you mentioned the one at the start of the primary season. What are some other places that we could actually do this? And what's the future for, I think you made the case too, that this needs to be scaled up, because what it's functioning to do is to actually change people, not just change the people's link to our representatives and people who are lawmakers and who are presidents and politicians, but it changes the people's investment and engagement with the political process and exposes them to opposing points of view. So do discuss this in your book, but tell our listeners how this is going to happen, what needs to be done to make it happen, and where in the political process we're going to institutionalize deliberation.
Let me step back a moment and say that in a way, I begin the book with ancient Athens, which used random samples to make a very important public decisions, random samples of 500. They even had a machine for selecting the random samples. Aristotle said about ancient Athens that, which was a very small society, between 30 and 60,000 adult males, and it was only males who could participate, adult male citizens. But they practiced a rotation method. Each person could rule and be ruled in turn because there were so many opportunities for deliberation. Now, that's been dismissed as a curiosity for a small city-state. But I created a catalog in the last part of the book of all the many ways in which we could have opportunities for deliberation that could touch the lives of more and more citizens. And at the large scale, I think we could have a rotation method where everybody would get their turn in one way or another. We're experimenting with spreading deliberative processes on our model in the schools all around the country. And I think that's a preferable form of civic education, or it could be a component of civic education in the schools and in universities. Many of the things that I mentioned in the last chapter of the book, we've actually tried in one place or another. For example, I live here in California, being a professor at Stanford University, and we get ballot propositions all the time. Now, the ballot propositions are the result of signature collections, which cost millions of dollars. And so moneyed interests tend to dominate the agenda setting of what gets on the ballot. So we actually had one case of where we used a deliberative process to generate the components of a ballot proposition and managed to get it on the ballot. But I think there ought to be a regular method by which public interest propositions can get on the ballot as the result of a deliberative process. Then secondly, once the ballot proposition is on the ballot and the 20-some states have the initiative, there should be deliberative polls to evaluate the ballot propositions. Right now, there are some small deliberative processes, more like juries that do that. But I think you need an adequate number of people to do the deliberations in order to meet the appropriate scientific standards so that people will have trust that the sample is really representative and they will understand the opinion changes. So you could have, as a regular matter, deliberative processes to evaluate and make recommendations for what other people ought to think about these ballots and the reasons why they should either consider supporting or opposing them. I think that deliberative processes could be used by corporations. We've actually done some projects with Meta about AI, and now we're doing it with other tech companies about what AI should be doing and should not be doing. And they've been working very well in countries around the world. We've done about 10 countries so far. And we also did one for Meta about the metaverse, bullying and harassment in the metaverse, what the ground rules should be for that. I think corporations should be encouraged to and would benefit by having representative samples of their customers on novel issues like the metaverse or AI. I think that corporations could use this for shareholder propositions. Shareholder democracy is sort of a joke, but it could be enlivened by having shareholders who can deliberate about how their shares ought to be voted. Right now, they're voted by the funds. If you have a retirement account, those funds are voted by whoever operates your retirement account. You, as a citizen, are also a shareholder. Your preferences about shareholder propositions ought to be represented, and you ought to have a chance to think about what those propositions are. I think that the list goes on and on. By the time I get through with the list, it would touch most aspects of life. And the result would be, first, every one of the things that I mentioned is a would be worth doing for its own sake. But if you add them all up, you could end up with a more deliberative society. I'll give you one more example, which was far-fetched and was not designed for the U.S., but it's certainly a surprising example. I'm just back from Mongolia. In Mongolia, we had a big celebration because there's a law that requires a national deliberative poll before the government can consider a constitutional amendment. And that law, then they have a lot of specifications for how the 700 people in the sample are chosen, which and they're chosen by the Census Bureau. They're highly representative, and people who participate make the journey to show up because they've been chosen to consider changes in the Constitution. The deliberative poll then takes place over a weekend, regulated by an independently elected advisory group. And then the results go to the parliament. And should the parliament choose by two-thirds vote, they can implement and they can pass a constitutional amendment. They've now done that twice. And the second time, they added proportional representation. Mongolia is a democracy, and the presidency and the parliament shift back and forth, highly competitive. The two parties dislike each other. And they have all the problems of social media, all the problems of misinformation that are familiar to us. And nevertheless, the public thought that they wanted more choices than the two major parties. So they added proportional representation in order to get some third parties elected. They had an election, more third parties were elected, and then they had a big celebration. So I flew to Mongolia for a big conference about our 10 years of work there, and the president awarded me their highest state honor, which was this medal, this gold medal, which I have sitting in my living room. And Stanford just put out a press release about that, which you can find on our website on deliberation.stanford.edu. It actually is a novel way of combining the deliberations of the people and the deliberations of the parliament. And that's a problem that all countries face, how to change constitutions. Our own system is a failure because it's too hard in a polarized environment to get a two-thirds vote of each house of Congress and then separate ratifications by three-quarters of the states, as is required by Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. It's too hard. We can't get constitutional amendments. And so we ought to think creatively about even ways of changing constitutions, maybe at the state level and then at the federal level eventually. It's very hard. But in any case, in countries around the world, that's an example of another a kind of application. But I've got the book's got lots of them, many of which we've piloted. And I think that if we all brainstorm about the context in which these kinds of processes could contribute, we will find more and more of them.
Certainly on Thinking Clearly, we have some motivated listeners over the years. What can folks like our motivated listeners do to help add more deliberative process into our existing systems?
I don't know. I think that advocating that deliberative processes could be part of the schooling system would be useful in local communities. There are also all kinds of local issues, housing, the environment, and the rest, that could be the subject of deliberative processes. Apart from my design, it's just the design of the deliberative poll seems to heighten the process and produce notable effects. But I think that the basic norms of listening to others in a civil way and trying to get an evidence-based resolution of conflicting issues, those are norms that we can take into life, into all of our experiences. Instead of just dismissing people who are from another party or have another viewpoint about a contested issue, engaging them in civil dialogue is something that we can all do.
And that blends so well into what we've been doing in the last few years on Thinking Clearly. So, Jim Fishkin, I want to thank you very much for sharing your research and your experience and ideas about deliberation and how it could make our democracy more effective, maybe get us out of this devastating period of extreme political polarization, help us move to a more informed, collaborative mode of governance. So on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your books, to your Stanford University faculty page, to the Deliberative Democracy Lab, and to the Wikipedia page that I think is pretty good for deliberative democracy. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post, Jim?
There's a link in preparation for the book itself. When I have that, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
When this podcast is out, can you send us a link and we'll post it on our webpage?
Certainly we'll do that. I want to, as I usually do, give a real shout out to our listeners and thank you for your support and thank you for listening. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.